what I would tell people is like, lead with love. And love isn't passive. Love is actually incredibly difficult, and it's pretty badass, and it's still very radical.
I think you just named the title of this episode. It should definitely be called Love is Pretty Badass.
I'm your host, Adam Mett, and today we're chatting with Maxwell Frost and Matt Deitch. They're friends and collaborators across the worlds of activism, mobilization, and fighting inequality. Matt was a founding member of March for Our Lives, the gun violence prevention organization started by students in Parkland, Florida, and has gone on to work with numerous human and civil rights organizations. Maxwell is a multidimensional activist as well, and is currently the organizing director of March for Our Lives. We talk about everything from Black Lives Matter to gun sense legislation, climate, music, mobilization, and of course, sustainability. I'm proud to call our guests today my friends. A quick reminder that we're planting a tree for every person who subscribes to this podcast, so make sure to hit that subscribe button. And without further ado, here are Maxwell and Matt on Planet Reimagined.
Both of you have had so many jobs and so many different roles. Maxwell, you were an organizing specialist at the ACLU, a national advance manager for Bernie Sanders, and now you're the national organizing director for March for Our Lives, but also you've been on the front lines every day of the Black Lives Matter movement. A few days before we recorded this episode, you were arrested. I know when we've spoken before, you were just tear gassed being out there. Can you talk a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's been frustrating and depressing from day one. I think most recently, though, especially here in Orlando, is we've had obviously a decline in numbers as the news and the media starts to move away from the movement going on. We're doing a series of protests right now in Orlando because the mayor of our county, Jerry Demings, is proposing a $15 million increase to the sheriff's department. And so obviously, I don't know how someone can sit here, watch the news with everything going on, and then sign off on an increase to the police. But either way, we're forced to now have to fight for like this middle of the road demand when our first demand was defund and move. And now we're fighting to keep it the same. And we see this in politics all the time. I call it calling the ref. If you're familiar with sports, you know, it's like calling the ref. And so either way, we were out by Universal doing a protest. And unfortunately, the police decided to arrest folks right before we got to our cars. We were like a block away. And as they started arresting folks, and one of the organizers, I walk up to one of the police calmly and say, "Hey, we're a block away." Before I could even finish my sentence, I was on the ground, face in the pavement, handcuffed me. He threw us in one of these paddy wagons where there's no AC and it's pitch black and it's all metal. And they brought us to jail. And I spent the night in jail. And it was a horrible experience. Obviously, I recognize I spent one night in jail. There's people who spend their life in jail. But that one night really opened my eyes to a lot of things. One of the correctional officers, the CEOs, asked the cop who arrested me, "What is he in for?" And then he said disorderly conduct. And, you know, I just came from a protest. I'm a little amped up, but I was like, well, it was actually a peaceful protest. And then all of a sudden, I have five COs that run up to me, get in my face, like, "Shut the fuck up. You're not in mama's house anymore, motherfucker." They grab me. Threw me to the floor, like I was in a fight. They put these stiff handcuffs on me, and they did it so tight that I actually still have cuts on my wrists, and I have pictures of it. Will be pursuing legal action. But either way, cuts on my wrist, lifted me up, slammed me against a glass door, and then dragged me into a solitary unit where they threw me in there for like six straight hours. It was cold, and there's no bed in it or anything like that. And it was a super traumatic experience. And I just think about folks who are in jail and in prison for crimes, and they're looking to change their life. And we know, statistically speaking, most people commit crimes because of poverty. But either way, I don't see how being in a place like that with bullies who are held unaccountable is going to rehabilitate or help change anyone's life.
Yeah. What has helped you to keep your spirit alive and keep going out and fighting?
I think it has to do with the other organizers I'm working with. When I'm organizing for my work job, I'm with a lot of people who've like consciously made the decision to like make a difference, and they've been doing it for a while and this and that, for the most part. Here in Orlando, like working on the ground with our collective of organizers, our group is called the People 407, and it's mostly people who've never done this before. It's people who are at home, they saw the video of George Floyd, they saw that was happening, they came out to a protest, they made a friend, and they ended up in a room with a ton of people who said, I want to do something and I want to be involved. And now they're out here planning these massive protests. being arrested, which is unfortunate, but putting their bodies on the line for something bigger. And so I think that's what's really pushing me to stay out here is the people I'm working with who've never done this before. Because like, if they can continue, I definitely need to, because I'm like someone who's consciously decided to dedicate my life to like justice. And I remember the point in which there was a call to action for me. And when I made that decision, it's a very small gap. You know what I mean? And so it's very easy to like fizz out. And so to see people that are right in the other room right now planning our action for tonight, we're doing a community dinner and a protest. That's what drives me.
We're going to talk more about all of that. But Matt, so you've had a large number of jobs as well. You've done strategy at Amnesty International. You were a fellow at Data Progress. You're on the board of Headcount. You were a founder of March for Our Lives and a former policy advisor to Bernie Sanders. It's such a range of different roles. What do all these things have in common, and what attracted you to this kind of range of different jobs?
At its core, I guess it was helping people. It's about doing the real work to bring people together, inform people, and try to build community in a place that is aggressively trying to take that from us. Whether it was March for Our Lives or Amnesty International, these larger institutions are really important in activating people, like Max said it before. And anything I can do to be a creative and a communicator in these spaces are the things that I want to do. And so I just have to say first, I'm a huge fan of both of you, and like a huge Maxwell Frost fan and a huge AJR and Adam fan. The sustainable partners stuff you're doing is incredible. It's exactly this kind of work that we're doing while having this conversation. It's about reaching people, because you never know what people are waiting to hear that they need to hear to be active. And then when people are active, we have all the power, we have all the movement, we have the momentum, and we're actually able to do the things that we need to do in order to make people's lives better. And so when there's so many different tactics and so many different ways that you have to go about it, I hate being boxed in as the political guy or the art guy, and I'm usually labeled as one or the other. But I like to just sort of talk about it in the way that it's communicating and connecting. It's about reaching out to people and building this sort of relationships. But we can also really build up the types of people that we need to build up in order to disrupt the injustices that are going on.
Yeah, no, I completely understand. And this idea of a box is what this podcast is all about. So many people see the word sustainability or sustainable as going green. And I study this. I don't even know what going green means. It's just a term that people have used to kind of simplify the really complex idea that is sustainability. And there's so much more to it. There is fighting for justice and fighting against inequality and strong institutions and getting corporations involved. So in a minute, we're going to talk more about that kind of breaking down the barriers of the box to include everything and see, like, kind of see how everything is connected. Just for context, can you talk a little bit about what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in February of 2018?
Yeah. So I mean, I can only speak from my perspective and sort of my experience with it. But I graduated from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas in 2016, and I left Parkland the week I graduated to study film in California, and found my way back through a lot of struggle back home in November of 2017. And I was working at my friend Jamal Lemmy's startup, which he was starting a t-shirt company, and he was doing graphic design work. And we had an intern, Joaquin Oliver, was a part of the project. Joaquin was like the energy behind the project. He was the model. He was the face. And we were supposed to film it on February 8th. And we bumped it a week. And he was killed on February 14th. So February 14th is my sister's birthday. My brother and sister were at the school that day. They're both okay, but they lost multiple friends. I have friends that lost siblings. I have coaches that were killed. 17 people were shot and killed, and 17 more were shot and injured in less than 7 minutes. And so it was horrific. And when something like that happens in Parkland, for context, Parkland is ranked the safest city in Florida. It's been that way for over a decade. Even today, you could ask anyone here and they'd probably tell you Parkland's safe. Nothing could ever happen here, even after the reality that it could happen here, it did happen here. And so following the shooting, well, first we had to come together. And so we just ended up going to the only house where there weren't parents, because a lot of parents were really adamant about us knowing our place and being quiet and taking the time to reflect. I can't tell you how many times I've heard grownups say to kids, like, your brain's not fully developed. You can't have an opinion. You can't fight for this because you don't know. You haven't lived yet. And so when we started organizing, we started speaking up, people started reaching out to us. And one of the first people to reach out to us was actually Maxwell Frost. And Maxwell was in my house that I'm in right now. He drove 3.5 hours to come and try to plan a concert with us because at first we didn't know what we were going to be doing for the march. The march was just one of the 100-something ideas we had. And we leaned on his Coachella and organizing experience to try to put this stuff together. And then that concert sort of became morphed into what the march became. And so if you remember the March for Our Lives, we had speakers from all around the country. No one was over the age of 18. Everyone had a personal experience connecting back to gun violence. And we were able to get some of the most talented performers to dedicate time to just show up for us.
So fast forward to today, March for Our Lives has gone through some transitions of what they're actually asking and advocating for. Where are we now? So for example, if there's a phone bank at March for Our Lives calling for something specific, what are we asking for in this moment?
You know, I think March for Our Lives over the past 2 years has gone through a transformation that the typical teenage left-leaning person has been going through for maybe the past year, right? With everything going on. I call that process radicalization. And that word might scare some folks, but what I call it is the process of learning that everything is messed up. Sorry, I was going to curse.
Go ahead, curse.
Everything's fucked up. I think the important thing about this is that, like, I went through it. People like Bernie Sanders and AOC have helped a lot of people learn about the inequities and the disparities within the disparities, and that the Democratic Party isn't always the best on things. And like, I grew up as like a young Dem, SGA president, you know, that kind of person. And like, going through that has changed my life. And so I think that a lot of that is what March for Our Lives has gone through too, is like learning about the fact that the typical gun violence prevention laws, which are very important, aren't going to completely end gun violence. I mean, gun violence is a symptom of a systematic issue, and we have to attack the issues at the core. You know, it's not so much taking guns away from people as it is making a world where people don't feel the need to buy guns in the first place. And so we talk about poverty, we talk about how climate change impacts that. But right now, obviously with the Black Lives Matter movement going on, something we're focused on is divesting and defunding the police and moving that money to violence interruption organizations and programs on the ground level. And they're all across the country, but they're not in every city. They're proven to stop gun violence. They take a localized approach at it, and they identify someone who's most likely to shoot someone, and they identify people who are most likely to be shot, and they go in as community organizers and end the gun violence on the ground. And actually, a lot of people don't know this, but George Floyd was a violence interrupter. So that's a lot of the work we're doing to honor him and to honor the work that people are doing. And, you know, as March for Our Lives, we had to take a step back and be like, where's our place in this movement? And after speaking with Black leaders across the country, this is where we thought our place would be in the current movement, is fighting to defund police and moving that money elsewhere.
Do you think that's a common thing among organizations now, having to become more nimble to figure out their space in COVID, in Black Lives Matter, in everything that's going on right now?
100% with COVID. I mean, I'll say I'm proud of March for Our Lives and the way we pivoted. I think we did very quickly. I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact that we're all Gen Z, you know, like all the organizers and stuff. As far as the racial and like the justice protests going on nationwide, it's tricky because yes, a lot of people are pivoting, which is good. We all need to pivot. It needs to be quick, but they're not taking a step back and recognizing the reason they're doing it and tying it to their issue. And a lot of folks aren't genuine about it. And we see this in a lot of big nonprofits where they'll hop on a bandwagon of something going on. And after a few months, it's gone. It's almost as bad as it is with corporations where they might have Black Lives Matter on the website right now. It'll be gone in about a month and that's it. And we see a lot of these big nonprofits do the same thing. And so I always like advocate, yes, hop in as soon as you can, but take a step back and see where your place is in this movement, because right now it needs to be led by Black folks.
Definitely. So one of the things I've been thinking about is the role that social media has played now. And at least in my memory, and I don't know if this is true, but the first big movement that relied on social media to organize was the 2011 Arab Spring. And the use of Facebook and Twitter and other social media platforms to organize, that's, at least in my consciousness, that's the first big moment that relied on social media for mobilization. How do you think social media has changed over the last bunch of years to become a real tool for mobilization and organization?
I think it's really interesting because if you look at what social media is sort of meant for, it's meant for instant gratification. It's meant to post, get a like, feel better about something, and get validated. And we've replaced community building with that, where people are building their communities through social media and online. And I think you can tell by the success of these social media movements through March for Our Lives and through a lot of the work through COVID, because of COVID, for this current like Black Lives Matter and Abolish the Police, Defund the Police. You can see that it's when you offer people an alternative to what they're used to, then that might be what creates that instant gratification and starts to snowball into something bigger. And so people get redirected in their community building to start building community with people who care about these same things as them. I also think it's incredibly disruptive because a lot of people go on social media and they can pull up the one clip that proves their point compared to the thousands of clips that prove the real issue. I read this article that was interviewing Senator Tim Scott, who was talking about how police brutality is clearly affecting Black people more than it's affecting non-Black people. But he couldn't say it. He couldn't say the words, like he couldn't get it out. And it's the inability to speak truth and the ability for the people in power to continue to sort of misdirect and misinform, I think, is also supercharged by social media. It allows for decentralized leadership, which I think is key in movement building. And it allows people to continue to engage certain leaders on like a very intimate level. But at the same time, a lot of it's just gratification, validation. It's what people want out of it. I've advised Twitter, Facebook, Instagram on projects around trying to keep people safer because me and a lot of my friends got death threats very early on while doing this work. Very serious threats that terrified a lot of people. And that's the point, is to scare people. But it's when this closeness is used to create violence and to censor people to the point where they're watching what they're saying, and a lot of these organizations watch what they say on social media. When that starts to happen and the tool becomes used more for something that's more authoritarian and fascist, we have to check it. And that hasn't happened yet. I think for our generation, we're more tuned to see what's bullshit and what's not. And I think that allows us to organize better on it. But I think if you see older people organizing online, they're just seeing whatever they want to see and they're yelling a lot of misinformation at each other.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a disagreement with our team in June when everyone was posting the black squares on Instagram. And I think they were posting on other platforms too. And I said, that sounds ridiculous to me. It's going to take people away from the information that they actually need. That's not doing anything, just posting a black square. But my team came back to me and said, look, you're going to get so much blowback as a band if you don't do this. So I kind of encouraged them to find this middle ground where we did end up posting a black square in the morning. But in our caption, we included a whole thing about how this is not enough. We want to stand in solidarity with everyone, but go to all these resources. So there's a kind of piece of this social media of feeling like you're involved in something. There's an element of slacktivism.
And I think it's going to be harder and harder to address on social media as facts get muddled and ideas get muddled. And right now, it costs us nothing to post on social media, but it is in fact a really big responsibility.
The UN has this set of 17 goals. They're called the Sustainable Development Goals. And there's so many pieces to it, but the first goal and the center of it is eliminating poverty around the world, because they see how much poverty is attached to education problems, healthcare issues, fighting inequality, the lack of strong institutions, gender equality, all of these other kind of pieces. And this podcast in particular is about making those connections between this idea of sustainability and seeing that there are many different prongs to the wheel and that they all affect each other. So a lot of the work that both of you have done kind of across the board is about giving voices to people who don't have a voice. And giving that voice to people is the first step towards combating inequality. Do you think that that's a fair assessment of your work so far?
Yeah. I mean, you can't listen to people who are away from the problem to talk about the problem. They're not going to solve the problem. They're not near the problem. Some of them, a lot of them benefit from the problem. So if your paycheck is determined by not acting, then you're not going to act.
Right. Yeah, I always find that completing work at the lowest possible level, meaning the people who are closest to the issue, is always the most effective. So you, if you can have something done in local government or a city council, they are, since they're on the ground and they know exactly what's going on, that's going to be the most effective. In the climate space, so many U.S. cities are moving towards wind and renewable energy, but we really can't get it done on the federal level. But it's great that it's happening in individual cities. And on that climate note, so many of the things that you guys work on are related to climate, and climate justice is this idea that everything is connected. Do you ever think about climate repercussions when you're fighting for justice in these other spaces?
Yeah, I definitely do all the time. And like, you know, we actually just did a whole conversation with Sunrise about this on live a few weeks ago, just talking about the fact that, you know, like I said earlier, gun violence is a symptom of many other issues. And climate justice is incredibly important because climate and our environment dictates how we live. And what we see is with gun violence is when folks resort to guns, they usually have been pushed to the edge, whether or not it's poverty. And so environmental issues are definitely connected to gun violence 100%. And, you know, we recognize that at March for Our Lives. I recognize it in my organizing. And also the fact that like our Indigenous brothers, sisters, and siblings wrote the playbook on fighting for justice, really in general, but also as far as preserving climate is concerned. And so I've taken a lot of time recently over the past year to really understand what it means to be connected with the world we live in and learning as much as I can from like my Indigenous friends around the country.
We can't talk about modern activism and this movement that's happening now without talking about the work that was done by the incredible Indigenous organizers at Standing Rock and the Water Warriors that brought attention to make climate something that is very real for people who were complacent in this fight.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Funny enough, my doctoral thesis focuses on Indigenous communities in this exact space. And I write about the incredible work that's being done in the sustainability space in so many different countries around the world. But at the same time, it's violating legal human rights of these Indigenous communities. In Kenya, I write about a wind farm that is bringing clean electricity to 22 million people in Kenya, which is amazing, but it's kicking many thousands of people off of their Indigenous land, which is obviously extremely problematic and violates international human rights norms. So the Indigenous question is such an important one here too.
And with the climate crisis, you can't talk about the climate crisis without talking about the refugee crisis that is directly attached to it. And one of the most impactful conversations I ever had in regards to helping me understand how climate connects to gun violence and connects to criminal justice reform, I had a conversation with leaders at Sunrise Movement. Shout out Varshini for her incredible work on the Joe Biden platform committee. She pushed them on climate. The work, it continues every day. But the conversation that we had was about how the refugee crisis in South and Central America, where we see people coming to our border desperate, and how it's directly associated with a lack of humanitarian aid that was a response to growing famines and lack of production of the farms down there. And so what is our government's response? It's mass incarceration. It's turning closed Walmarts into prisons and losing thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And so it's hard because we want to tackle these things at the hyper-local level, but we also need to take a step back and see how they connect at this global scale, because the people who are facilitating the climate crisis, this isn't something that we like stumbled into. This is something that was aggressively planned, and it was planned at the global level. And our response has to be radical solidarity with everyone around the world who's fighting this.
Absolutely. The kind of next thing that I want to talk about is the relationship between emotion and movement building, because I think it's such an important piece of this. And I want to hear from both of you what role you feel anger and fear played in building movements, and if it's a positive thing or if it's a negative thing in movement building.
I think, yeah, it does play a huge part in movement building. And I don't think it's a negative thing. I think any emotion can bring you to the table. I think then it is the job of organizers who are in the space to help people redirect the energy, moving it from a like righteous anger to like a radical love. Because like we as human beings, we are wired to love way longer than we are, you know, hating. Like hating is very exhausting. I mean, you know, I always make the distinction too. It's like if you're brought into some type of religion or Christianity solely on the basis that you're scared of hell or something like that, I think you're less likely to be as committed to whatever that practice is because you came in on the basis of fear and you stayed on the basis of fear. And so for movement building, I try my best to acknowledge people's anger because I'm also angry. What I always tell people is like lead with love, and love isn't passive. Love is actually incredibly difficult and it's pretty badass and it's still very radical. But it's also the way we're going to sustain the movement and make the change we need to make.
I think you just named the title of this episode. It should definitely be called Love is Pretty Badass.
Yeah, I was just going to say about emotion, I think a lack of emotion is where we're seeing the complacency. Complacency comes from this rise of authoritarian fascist traits. And when you're repressing your thoughts and what you're seeing and what you're experiencing, one of the deadliest traits of an authoritarian regime is that you can't live your experiences. You can't actually validate the things that you're understanding and feeling. And so if you're not angry about something right now, then you're not looking around long enough. And if you're not inspired or feeling that radical love that Max is talking about, then you're not looking around either, because there are so many incredible people right now doing the real work in building a new community. The new world has already been born, and it's being organized right now by people from all walks of life, and no one's born with all the answers. And one of the best things an organizer can do is take a step back and say, okay, I'm not going to have all the answers, but I know that if we are democratic and we are organizing and we're listening to everyone and we're radically inclusive to the point where you are really trying to seek a deeper understanding, and how can we organize people in a way that communication is moving us forward, moving us closer together instead of further apart. And so I think these emotions are healthy. And I think early on in my organizing, we were pressed all the time to not feel anything. If we had smiled in a picture, we get shit for it because they were like, you're smiling right after a mass shooting, blah, blah, blah. Like you can never smile again after a tragedy happens to you. Or people were giving us shit for being sad, for being angry, and for yelling at people or raising our voice. And then they talk about civility, and all those things are just rooted in keeping the status quo the way it is. And so I think that we need to be inspiring people to feel these things, to be angry, to cry if they need to cry, to scream if they need to scream. We can't repress the things that we're experiencing because that is literally killing us. And so I don't know if it's going to be fear. I don't know if it's going to be what will be the motivation to getting people around climate. I know personally the way that I've activated people is around teaching people their power, that you as an individual can make a difference together. It's about respecting the individual while removing individualism from the equation, because so many people get involved in this work. They take up a lot of space and they take up a lot of resources. And then you see people like Jeff Bezos give $2 billion to a fund to basically steer climate investment. And when that investment is going towards industries that are facilitating the destruction of our planet, we need to talk about what actions we have to take. And in the words of John Lewis, he said, we need the idea of good trouble. Not everything right is legal. And that's something really hard for people to get a hold of. If you defend the rights of a fascist before you defend the rights of Black Americans or Jewish Americans or any other group of people in this country that do not have full-fledged rights in this country, we need to take a step back and talk about that. And we're not built right now for conversation. We're built for confrontation. And we have to build the space to actually have that sort of radical community that can involve all people, because that's the way that we get out of this climate crisis.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've been thinking a lot about this idea specifically in the climate space and how, you know, Greta Thunberg's work and AOC's work and Al Gore's work, even Bill McKibben's work, they're all amazing, but they've all been built out of this idea of fear of the future. And so many people in the United States don't fear or are not angry at the climate because that's something really difficult to get angry at and angry about. Black Lives Matter movement was built so much out of fear and anger. And yes, all these things you're talking about, transitioning it into this kind of love and energy. But climate, I've been kind of struggling with how to get people really focused on it. So I thought, what if we tried to do the opposite? What if we tried to build a new movement out of excitement as opposed to anger? there are a few groups that do an unbelievable job at building things from excitement. And those are the music industry, the fashion industry, and the sports industry. They are literal experts at building campaigns to excite people in many different ways. So I've been thinking a lot about how we can kind of take the tools that music and sports and fashion have taught us to build a movement out of excitement where people want to get involved, even if the day-to-day of it is not touching them.
On the music industry, this is something I think about all the time too. Something I've learned from one of my Indigenous friends from the International Indigenous Youth Council is this whole concept that, number one, like, organizing isn't just a means to an end, right? Like, being in the work could be saving someone's life, giving someone a purpose, giving someone fulfillment. That is similar to music. And when you, you know, become a fan of a band, when you become a fan of AJR, you listen to their music all the time, and you're excited to go to the concert, there's not really a means to an end. There's not an end destination that you're really thinking about. What's keeping you in the fight is how you feel in the moment. And that's why I always prioritize as like an organizer, making sure people feel good about the work they're doing, because I think it's important for longevity. I mean, I remember what got me into live music was Super Bowl halftime show, Bruno Mars. I remember it changed my life, you know, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers came out and I was like, I want to do that. Yeah, sure, I want to play the music, but I want to like make that happen. And so people always thinking back to that one moment, you know, an organizing call, like the call to action. What is that? My call to action for music, live music, was Bruno Mars halftime show at the Super Bowl. Because whenever things are tough, whenever you get arrested, whenever you're being tear gassed or pepper sprayed, you can think back to that moment and how you felt. And that can propel you, you know, through the fight.
That's amazing.
Yeah. The joy is so important. This has to be joyous. Something I've been seeing a lot about at these protests, there's been so many dance circles. There's been so much music in the streets. And you can look back in some of the more powerful movements around the world. In apartheid South Africa, Nelson Mandela would go around with the biggest bands and he would let the band perform for 45 minutes. He'd come out, do a 5-10 minute speech, get everyone riled up. They'd remember the speech and then there'd be an encore and there's a band playing again. And Maxwell hit it right on the head. We just have to find new ways to bring people together. But like you said, with music, entertainment, sports, joy is such a central component to it. And I feel like a lot of the time when we're talking about organizing, we have to highlight trauma. We have to talk about the trauma that's going on in this country. We have to talk about the darkest things that are happening in this country around genocide and mass incarceration and everything. But we also need to remember that people are capable of joy. Everyone is capable of tapping into that and loving each other and learning how to love each other in a new and powerful way. And I feel like we lose that a lot of the time. And I think a lot of that has to do with sort of the corporate culture of keeping to yourself and anything that has to do with work being more isolation than being a public figure. Like as a musician, you always have to be sort of accessible to the people who love you. And as an organizer, a lot of organizers can turn that on and off. But I think it's about not only being accessible to others and loving everyone, but finding ways to be accessible to yourself and loving yourself and being kind to yourself. And in that way, finding the way to be kind to others and spread that joy.
Yeah. There's a folk artist named Phil Oakes, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, from the 1960s. He said, "If there's any hope for America, it lies in a revolution. If there's any hope for a revolution in America, it lies in getting Elvis Presley to become Che Guevara." And that's resonated with me, the power and role that musicians, artists, anybody in that space has to build movements to inspire people and bring ideas forward.
Yeah, and you can kind of see that, like there's like little microcosms of it everywhere, like in a lot of the Saba, Smino, Isaiah Rashad, like rap scene, like someone like No Name who's like completely changed her Twitter to become a place to radicalize and teach folks. I've seen like that community drastically change as far as like thoughts about capitalism and the way things work. And so like shout out to No Name on that, and a lot of the musicians like yourself, Adam, who are like taking their platform. It's more than just using your platform, because I think using your platform can be weaponized in a way where we're okay with like the bare minimum. You know what I mean? Yeah.
The black squares. And
the black squares, or the video where you're singing the song and then that's all you do.
Yeah.
Look, I'm fine with the singing the song video if you do more. If that's the end of the road, then I'm not fine with the singing the song video. But either way, I just want to echo that. It's definitely extremely important. That's why, like, I March for Our Lives, and in anything I do, I'm always looking to engage musicians locally, but also like nationally, and kind of everything we're doing.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a couple questions about politics before we wrap up. How do you reconcile the idea that building movements have been focused on younger generations for forever, but at the same time, there is such low voter turnout for young people? How do you reconcile those two things?
They're directly connected. The amount of money that goes into corporate media shaming young people from voting and talking about how young people are lazy or young people don't care, and then they go to the one person on the man on the street and you find those kids. The reality is most people in America don't vote, full stop. It's not because most people in America don't want to vote. It's because it's not accessible. And so young people are excited, are organizing, but also young people have a lot of commitments. A lot of young people have student loans. A lot of young people have multiple jobs they have to work. And like most working people, you don't have access to the ballot box when Florida is not one of the states that has to give you time off to vote. So if you're working on election day and your county doesn't offer early voting and you get to the polling place and the line's really long and you just worked a 12-hour shift and you're just trying to get through this, it becomes so hard for people, and it doesn't have to be that hard. It's purposefully hard. Voting, we could have same-day registration. Everyone could vote. We could have it so that you could vote by mail or online. But we've never had a fair election in America. We've never had anything close to a democracy in America. When you have people willing to spend billions compared to whatever organizations like MFL have in their yearly budget, and MFL is one of the few organizations, they're few and far between, that are aggressively focusing on youth turnout at the national and state level, then that number starts to make sense. And you start to look at 30% turnout as incredible when you factor in all of these obstacles, but it's still incredibly disappointing. Because you learn in this country that if this was the case somewhere else, then we probably wouldn't treat it like it was any kind of democratic state.
Yeah. No, I was just going to echo everything Matt said. You know, when we talk about a lot of these easy moves that we can make, National Voter Registration Day, a holiday, automatic voter registration, stuff like that, I think a lot of times people are so bogged down in like the dogma of how America's been. And we forget that this is a democratic experiment. Personally, I think we need to make some radical changes to get the youth vote up, but also create lifelong voters. Like, I believe in lowering the voting age to 16 for a plethora of reasons, because young people are voting for their future. You know, we need to do like the Catholics do. You know, they get them young. You get baptized at birth. People to develop habits need to start young.
Hmm. Would either of you ever consider running for political office?
I almost did run this cycle. I was trying to, I wasn't trying to. I was trying to recruit someone to run in a seat. And when I couldn't, I had shifted to, okay, if I can't recruit someone, I just have to do it and show people that it's not that hard. And then I saw that they changed the date that you usually have to submit it. And then it was really hard because the bureaucrats in Tallahassee kept me on hold for multiple days, dragged my leg. Mm. It was rough, but yeah. So I was contemplating that. I was very serious about that. Do I want to be an elected official? Not really. I just want to show young people everywhere that they can because they need to. Because I mean this. I've spoken to so many people around the world in so many different spaces. And the smartest people I've met are between the ages of 12 and 16. And they're reading every day. They're living every day. They're free. They're truly free in the way that they're experiencing this life. And they're radical and they're excited and they have these great ideas. And the dumbest people I've met run billion-dollar corporations and are traveling the world and have a platform and are on TV every day. And the ideas that are circulating in those circles are the same ideas that they've had for 100-something years. Young people have a lot less ties to the corruption that is destroying our planet. And so I call on young people to run for office, and it's really hard to put yourself out there. But once you do it and you can show that you're not afraid, then you see what people are capable of. You see the change that starts to happen. Some of the most incredible people that I know who have been elected officials are elected officials at 18 years old, 20 years old. Tay Anderson in Colorado is drastically shifting Colorado's conversation around. He got police out of schools in Denver. They shifted the budget. These things only happen when we are actually in people's faces and demanding them. you don't end fascism by appealing to it. Like, you don't end authoritarianism by appealing to it. Like, you need to actually organize and topple it. And part of that includes running for office, at least right now.
So for me, you know, yeah, my answer is like maybe sometime in the future. There's something that that Obama said that I always like think about, and that kind of changed my life. He's talking to a group of interns at the White House, and he was like, "Your goals say a lot about you." I'm paraphrasing. If your goal is to have this specific position at a specific place, doing a specific thing, it's a bit of a selfish goal, which is okay. Sometimes we need to be selfish in life. But if your goal is, I want to do this in life, it's a bit more selfless. So like, my goal in life is to help people through politics, movement building, and music. I go with the flow, and I like to go where my heart tells me to go. If I wake up one morning and I have an epiphany and I'm like, I need to run for this seat, or I need to run for mayor or this office or school board, and I feel like that's the next thing I need to do, I'll do it because it's in service of my goal. I may never wake up with that thought. I may wake up with that thought. So I never want to count it out, but it's definitely not a goal.
So we as a band, and we as an organization, Sustainable Partners, get so many young people reaching out to us saying, I want to get involved in something. I don't know what to get involved in, but I want to be part of something. What is step one?
I think the first thing is figure out what exactly you want to help with, even though it's all connected. What lens do you want your work to shine through? And so if someone says, oh, well, climate, well, you know, I would tell someone to go on Google and look up different organizations within their area. But also, like, for climate, I would say Sunrise Movement, like an amazing, great organization that's doing some great work. For gun violence prevention, March for Our Lives. The Dream Defenders, which is like my favorite, doing a lot of youth movement work. I would say just use the internet as a resource and figure out a bunch of different great organizations that you can volunteer with and be involved with.
Every time I do any sort of speaking or organizing, I always get asked that question, usually by someone who can't vote. So usually someone who's under the age of 16, who would vote if they could, but voting age is 18. And I usually tell people to drop the how and start with the what. Like, what do you actually care about? And what are you good at? Stick to what you're good at. Because being an organizer is dropping that how. How is together. We're figuring that out together. It's no one person coming up with how. That's how you get these sort of professional activists and professional revolutionaries. And what we need is a collective. We need people coming together. And so Max hit it right on the head. Dream Defenders, shout out to them. Sunrise Movement, March for Our Lives. But there are so many other organizations out there that don't even have a logo, may not even have social media or anything to really contact them on. But there are people everywhere on the ground organizing. This is happening. And people may not be aware of it, but it's about looking around your surroundings. If you're entering these spaces and you don't have a developed politic, it might be very hard. You may not feel like you fit in. It might be alienating. It's about building relationships with those who are really connected to doing the work. And so, yeah, all those websites are great websites. But I think a lot of it has to do with like looking around the types of people in your community and the types of people who you're already talking to about these things. Because March for Our Lives was started through people in a group chat. It was a group chat of texts and we came together on a floor and there were 30 something of us. And years later, it's still a massive organization and people are still getting activated every day who had never organized before because of it. It's not the goal is to have sustainability, but it's to continue activating new people. It's to continue building this momentum. Because I say this every day. I say every day there's more of us, but then you start to feel it when you start realizing that the people you're talking to are more and more, and the people they're talking to are more and more. And you start seeing town halls popping up in rural communities on Zoom where they're interviewing state senator candidates. And you see 16-year-old organizers that you haven't seen in 2 or 3 years pressing them really hard because there's no local journalism anymore. So it has to be run by students. At its core, it's about building that relationship. And if people can start to transform themselves in it, they can start to transform others too.
Thank you both so much. So this has been incredibly inspirational and is an incredibly important conversation. Before we go, would you let the listeners know how to find you online and the work that you're doing and how to contact you moving forward?
Yeah. So Maxwell Frost, my Twitter is @therealfrost_. My Instagram is frostymax @FROSTYMAX. My last name is Frost, Frosty, Frosty the Snowman. Yes. And feel free to DM me or reach out to me. I'm happy to plug people in either organizations that are nonprofits, or even just like local organizations, like I'm a part of here in Orlando, the People 407. We're not a nonprofit. We're just a bunch of like young people who meet every night and try to put together protests to change our locality and change how everything's going. So please reach out if you'd like to about anything political or movement related or music related too. I love music.
Yeah, my Twitter is at MattXRed and my Instagram is just my name, Matt Deitch. I'm easy to find. I answer most of my DMs. I get a lot of DMs asking this type of question. How do I get involved? How do I become an activist? And people are really shocked when I answer and like actually walk them through different ways that they can get involved. And I encourage people to reach out to as many people as possible. We do see everything. Every person on social media does see everything, unless they have someone running their socials. Then they don't see it. But you can tell by KD having the burner account that he sees every tweet that you send at him. And so if you want to bug people on social media, bug them. But also if you want to reach out for advice, I highly recommend it.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for today. It's been an incredible conversation. I hope you all felt it was inspiring and interesting, and definitely reach out.
Thanks so much for listening. If you want to support this podcast, please visit sustainablepartnersinc.org/donate. Also, follow us on Instagram at sustainable.partners. Today's episode was engineered by Drew Alsbrook, produced and edited by Shelby Kaufman, and executive produced by Sustainable Partners, Inc. I'm your host, Adam Mett, and thanks for listening to Planet Reimagined.